Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 27th, 2006. Our session today is entitled, What is the Theology of the Cross? Our presenter is Fred Niedner, session number NIF 2006-12. Let's listen in.
We're always burning sessions onto some sort of digital thing or another. Welcome to Theology and Bowling. My name is Fred Niedner. I'm from Valparaiso, Indiana, and I teach in the Department of Theology at Valparaiso University. My area of teaching is actually Bible. I'm not a scholar of the Lutheran Confessions or a systematic theologian like my friend and colleague Michael Pellett here, who has come to give a boost and an assist if need be, or to keep me honest. Can't trust Bible people, you know. But in any case, this session is being offered, What is Theology of the Cross, for a couple of reasons. One is that you hear that language a lot in circles like folks that come, in circles such as the folks that come to Holden, partly because that's a very common term among Lutherans, and there's a lot of Lutherans at any given time up here at Holden. Theology of the Cross is also a piece of the language in a lot of Holden's historic documents, including the current mission and vision documents of Holden Village. And so we thought we'd have a session on what is that kind of talk about here at Holden among the among our circles. I offered a session on this a couple days ago for the board of directors, and this is kind of a repeat of that session, although it cannot be exactly the same because it's as much discussion as it is presentation. And the discussion that we'll have in a few minutes will determine how the session will go. And that's a reality about theology of the cross. It is always a theology that is that grows in and out of a context. And so every context is different. In fact, from a Saturday board meeting to a Monday night, or a Tuesday night session, the context is already slightly different. It's also the stuff of proclamation and preaching and sharing the faith more than it is a specific systematic theology that can be bottled and handed on in one place and in one way. Some of you who have been to my sessions on Bible know that it's my custom to start with alleged hilarity. And I always tell people that we have to start that way in case none happens naturally. I don't really have anything quite like that tonight, except it is sort of hilarious just to meet in a bowling alley and talk theology. And as I told the board, if I had the capacity to make this a multimedia presentation here in the bowling alley, I wouldn't actually do any bowling for you. Or even go set pins, which, as Paul Hinderle explained last night, was my first job ever. I got my Social Security number back when I was about 10 years old, setting pins in the bowling alley in West Point, Nebraska. I could tell you a lot of stories that are hilarious about that, although I didn't think they were funny at the time. A lot of drunk guys trying to hit the pin boys with balls. You had to watch the bowlers more carefully than the pins. But if I could do a multimedia presentation for you, I would have brought along a little film clip that a student gave me of an alleged trailer for a new movie called The Greatest Action Story Ever Told. And it's a story of an Arnold Schwarzenegger Terminator-type fellow who tries to protect Jesus. He enters the age of Jesus, and he goes around with his special vision and his high-powered weapons, and he goes around shooting Romans who are a threat to Jesus, and most of it is he keeps killing Judas. And Jesus has to keep making Judas alive again so that the story can continue the way it's supposed to go. And the Terminator keeps saying, No, I come to protect you. And so on and so on. I can tell that you had to be there. So we'll just move on. It's kind of a risky thing to espouse theology of the cross for several reasons. It's even more dangerous to embody it than to espouse it. It got Martin Luther tossed out of the church. Even before Martin Luther, it got St. Francis, who probably embodied it as much as any human being since Christ himself. It got him totally co-opted by the church and used for purposes that he certainly would never have intended. It's terribly misunderstood. It's most often ignored, and it's commonly practiced in name, but in name only, and practiced mistakenly. It's terribly misunderstood. I went to a conference a couple years ago in Denmark. The University of Aarhus over in Denmark sponsored a worldwide meeting of Lutheran theologians to discuss the future of Lutheran theology. And almost everybody there said that they were working with theology of the cross, and almost no two of the understandings of it were alike. So you should know that this is sort of my take on it, but not my take alone. It's my take as learned partly from my teachers, but partly from a couple of people who I can refer to you. If you want to study this any further, I highly recommend this book by Douglas John Hall. I think there might even be a copy or two of it in the Holden bookstore. The Cross in Our Context, Jesus and the Suffering World. It's a kind of a distillation of his three-volume magnum opus. He's a theologian of the cross who's a systematic theologian, retired now. He's a Canadian, and he taught in Canada. If you want to get slightly more brave, you can read this book by Gerhard Ferdi on being a theologian of the cross. He's recently deceased, theologian at Luther Seminary in St. Paul. Reflections on Luther's Heidelberg Disputation of 1518. This little book also gives you a take on theology of the cross. Theology of the cross begins with a question, and it's the question to which this year's theme verse here at Holden is the answer. The answer is, I am with you always. That's Christ's answer to the question in Matthew's gospel at the end as he is parting from the disciples. And that is actually an answer to the question, where is the risen Christ and what is the risen Christ doing these days? But for Christians, that's also the answer to the question, where is God? And I've been asking that question here the last couple of weeks as it's posed, and it's been talked about in several sessions these last days, so you will have heard this multiple times perhaps. One of the most profound ways the question has been asked in our era is in the way that Elie Wiesel asks it in his little memoir of his days in a concentration camp, when he tells the story of the camp having been assembled one afternoon to witness the hanging of three individuals accused of participating in an act of sabotage. And the officers of the camp hung these three people, and one of them was a 13 or so year old child who was not heavy enough, didn't have enough weight to his body to make the noose work properly. And so for more than half an hour, he hung there, twitching and gradually turning blue, and between land and sky, between life and death. And Wiesel says he heard someone ask behind him, where is God now? And he said a voice from within him answered, "There is God hanging on that gallows." And of course, the way Wiesel meant that was, in that moment, there was the death of everything that he could believe about God. His idea of God, his theology died in that moment. There was nothing more to talk about. Of course, you all know that that did not remain the case for Wiesel. He has gone on as a post-Holocaust theologian to talk a lot about God. But that is precisely the Christian answer to the question as well. Where is God now, hanging there on that gallows? At least from the point of view of the theology of the cross, that is the answer. Because the fundamental premise of the theology of the cross is that there is only one place to look if you want to see God and know what God is about. You look at the crucifixion of Jesus. That is where theology starts. That's where it ends, because it's also an eschatological event. It's an end time event. It's an ultimate event, we say in Christian theology. But theology, God talk, the stuff we use to talk about God and what God is like and who God is and what God is up to in the world, starts there on the cross of Jesus Christ. The language itself, theology of the cross, is usually attributed to Martin Luther, and I'll explain how it started and how Luther used it, but it's really much older, the phenomenon of theology of the cross is much older than Luther, of course. It's the bedrock of the Christian faith and goes back to the preaching and teaching of the apostles, and for us, it's accessible in the canon of Scripture. But Luther posted his 95 theses, as we all know, in 1517, and by 1518 he was in deep doo-doo, and he was called to several kinds of disputations and ultimately trials in order to account for what he was teaching, and he began to use this theology of the cross language at a disputation in 1518 in Heidelberg, and he produced for this disputation a whole list of theses about, you know, to explain his theology, and I'm just going to read a few of them. I'm not going to pause and talk about them because that would be another whole session. How do you make sense out of Luther's particular statements? But just to give you a sample of where this language first comes from. The person does not deserve to be called a theologian who looks upon the invisible things of God as though they were clearly perceptible in those things which have actually happened. That is, Luther believed in a God who was hidden. You couldn't just look around in the world and say, "Oh, there's God," or "Oh, there's God." This is a choice, obviously. Luther says God hides God's self behind the things of the world. We can't, at least unambiguously, discern God in the things that are around us. I'll get back to that in a moment. He, and this is Luther talking, not me, so that's why the non-inclusive language. He deserves to be called a theologian, however, who comprehends the visible and manifest things of God seen through suffering and the cross. So, you're not a theologian if you think you see God everywhere. You're a theologian, a Christian theologian, if you see God in the suffering of Jesus on the cross. A theologian of glory calls evil good and good evil. A theologian of the cross calls the thing what it actually is. So he posits always the difference between theology of the cross and theology of glory. And I will contrast those for you in a couple minutes. That wisdom which sees the invisible things of God in works as perceived by man is completely puffed up, blinded, and hardened. The law brings wrath of God, kills, reviles, accuses, judges, and condemns everything that is not in Christ. Yet that wisdom is not of itself evil, nor is the law to be evaded. But without the theology of the cross, man misuses the best in the worst manner. So that's the section of the Heidelberg Disputation Theses where this language comes from. Now, I'm not going to try to explain all that, but I will, but through a series of my own theses that I'm going to... That's how you do it in Lutheran theology, right? I have 16 theses tonight. There's also a famous quote of Luther from this same period in which he simply says, "The cross alone is our theology." And this theology did form the basis of the Lutheran confessional documents when they tried to explain themselves before the emperor on June 25th in 1530, that we just celebrated that the other night in the Eucharist. They wrote this Augsburg Confession, and then Melanchthon, Philip Melanchthon, Luther's sidekick, wrote the apology, that is the explanation or the defense of the Augsburg Confession. And in that defense of the Augsburg Confession, Melanchthon trotted out his toolbox, his theological core values, we might say, and explained, for example, how he and how the Lutheran reformers could tell the difference between genuine gospel and stuff that wasn't genuine gospel. And in Article 4 of the Apology to the Augsburg Confession, there's a very clear statement that I find helpful for discussing theology of the cross. Melanchthon wrote that you can tell genuine gospel when it does two things. A, it honors the cross of Christ, the crucifixion of Christ. And B, it comforts penitent hearts. If preaching or theology does not do those two things, it might be very interesting, and you might even get a lot of people to follow you, but A, it's not what the reformers were up to, and B, it's not genuine gospel, at least according to their lights. And the first part of that, honoring the death of Christ, that's got two sides to it as well. The way they meant that you honor Christ is by accounting somehow in your teaching and preaching for both the necessity of Christ's suffering and for the sufficiency, the effectiveness, the completeness of Christ's suffering. That's all that need to happen for Christ to be the Savior and for God to have done the ultimate act that needed doing in the world. So, if you ever go around saying things like Luther's and the Reformers' opponents were saying, namely that you gotta do some stuff in addition to believing Christ, well, that dishonors Christ's death because it says Jesus' solution was only about 60%. We gotta add 40. So, nice try, Jesus, but didn't quite work. We gotta add more. Or you could say it's partially unnecessary. So, geez, that was really nice of you to die, Jesus, but you didn't really need to go that far. That's dishonoring the cross. So to honor the death of Christ, you must say that it is both sufficient and necessary. And then finally, any preaching has to finally comfort penitent hearts and not leave people trusting still in themselves or trusting in things about which... they're left guessing their relationship to God. Luther got to this place by asking that question, where is God? Though Luther's question was, where can I find the gracious God? If you've ever seen a biography of Luther, you know he was a man who was, some of us might say he was neurotic or something, and there have been whole biographies that blamed it all on his toilet training and so forth, that he was a perfectionist, that he simply could not satisfy himself that he could ever get anything right. But that is what he came to believe about himself, that he was finally incapable of getting anything completely right. And he found in the book of Romans, at least some comfort in the fact that the Apostle Paul seemed to have been in the same boat, The good that I would, I do not, and the evil that I would not, I do every time. What is the matter with me? What kind of wretched critter am I that I'm wired so that even the stuff I know to do, I can't do right? Well, Luther went looking for a gracious God, and the only place he could finally find a gracious God is in the proclamation of the elements of the New Testament that he found to proclaim what he came to call the theology of the cross. In Mark's gospel, for example, in which Jesus dies crying the great human prayer, my God, why you too? And here's the man who lived the perfect life, or at least we say that, and this is what it gets you. This is what living the perfect life gets you in this world. They kill you at a young age. You don't even get to live out your 70 years. And Jesus dies asking why. And in Mark's gospel, you remember, it's precisely in that moment when he dies that way that Mark tells us a moment of revelation happens. The second rending of the heavens takes place. That's revelation language. And the centurion standing there by the cross, the first human being in the entire Gospel of Mark to say this without benefit of demon possession, says, this was the Son of God. This is the great moment of revelation in the Gospel of Mark, the moment of Jesus' death. It's the crucifixion. Or in John's Gospel, Jesus over and over says, now it's time for my glorification. I'm on my way to be glorified. But we know, the reader, because the narrator slips it between the lines and tells us he said this to show by what death he was to die. And in John's Gospel, Jesus cries out, it is finished! Not when he comes roaring out of the tomb, but when he dies. In the moment of his death, he cries, it worked! It's the death of Jesus that is the center. That is the moment of the saving. That is the moment of ultimate revelation. Well, what does that moment say about God? If this is the moment that we look at, and this is the moment that reveals God, what does that reveal? Well, what that reveals, of course, is the gracious God that Luther was looking for. And that's what I want to try to explain. How does that moment become the revelation of the gracious God that Luther was looking for? And so what? What does it mean to believe that and to follow along? I'm going to offer you a few theses. The first part simply summarizes and repeats what I've said. And beyond what I've said here, I find it nearly impossible to say what the theology of the cross is, because it's a whole lot easier to say what it's not than to say what it is. It is not, for example, triumphalism, and it is not ideology. And so it's all kinds of stuff that the world really isn't very interested in. But here are my theses on theology of the cross. As I've already said, number one, if you want to see God, you look to the cross of Christ, to the passion of Christ, the story of the crucifixion. Two, that vision, that event, is God with us in the most wretched moment of human misery, failing, suffering, and cussedness. That moment represents the worst that could happen to somebody and the worst that human beings can do to each other. There's not much that could ever happen worse than that. And there is God present as the suffering one in the midst of that moment. That is God with us. Douglas John Hall states it like this in his book, the world is full of pain, God loves the world only by joining the world in its pain can God act out God's love for the world. That's the third point. And the fourth point is that alternative remedies would be bound to fail for a variety of reasons. To fix the world would not be to love it. But that's what we would like God to do, is not to come suffer and die with us, but to fix the world so there didn't have to be any suffering and dying in the first place. If you ever want to work on that problem, the place to go is to study the story of Jesus' temptation in the Gospels of Matthew and Luke. Matthew 4 and Luke 4 tell the story of Jesus being offered that kind of definition for messiahship. You know, Jesus, if you could turn stones into bread, you could fix the world so there's no more hunger for anything. If you could turn stones to bread, why, you could turn stones to medicine, you could turn stones to VCRs and cell phones and Game Boys and cars and whatever, oil. We would never have to want for anything. And we would never, therefore, have to fight each other for anything that was in short supply, because there would never be short supply. That would be the perfect world, God, if you made it so that every one of us had enough of absolutely everything that we want. There would be no more want. That would fix the world, right? Or we would like it if Jesus would fix the world so that not just he could jump 430 feet from the top of the temple to the Kidron Valley below and land at the bottom and say, ta-da, see, it works, trust me. What we really want is for him to jump down that distance with us on his back while he jumps over not the Kidron Valley, but the Valley of the Shadow of Auto Accident, and the Valley of the Shadow of Cancer, and the Valley of the Shadow of all the things that have killed our loved ones and our children, so that we had to bury them too young. And everyone would get their 80 years and die happily in their beds with the grandchildren gathered around singing them over to the other side. That's the world we want. So fix the world, Jesus. Or Jesus is offered the kingdoms of the world. All he has to do is take over Satan's way. And Satan's way is the way of Rome. That's the context of that time. Rome's way is to take over the world by means of fear and for the sake of gain, which is the way every empire in the history of the world has ever taken over and made peace. Peace of Rome, the Pax Americana, it's exactly how we do it. You do it our way or we nuke you, or at least we'll try. So Jesus, fix the world. And Jesus does not fix the world. What does Jesus do? He sets his face towards Jerusalem and he goes up there to die. Why doesn't he fix the world? All we know is that he didn't, and that he chose this other path. He doesn't say, I'm doing it, I got this other plan, and here it is. He just goes and does it. But I think we can imagine that the world I was imagining as fixed through the story of the temptation is a world in which we would be automatons. That's utopia. That's what we're always after, the fixed world by our own designs. And we would be incapable of love. We would be puppets in somebody else's puppet show in the totally fixed world. Fifth point. All theologies that look elsewhere for a starting point, of theology, end up in triumphalism, or in ideology, or in crushed naivete of some kind or another. Even if you start with the resurrection instead of with the cross. And that's what a lot of theologies do. You start with the resurrection and you say, see, ultimately there's a happy ending. That's what it's really all about, is the happy ending. That's the fixed world. We really want the fixed world. You know, maybe we can handle a little bit of suffering, but what we're really after is the fixed world. We don't want really a Jesus who's going to really, truly come die with us. So you look at the resurrection, you end up, I mean, if that's where you start, obviously the resurrection is terribly important, but if you start even with the resurrection, you end up in the wrong place. Luther would say, if you look at nature, you've lost yourself as well, because nature is an ambiguous revealer of God. Yes, the sunsets are beautiful. Yes, the mountains are beautiful. But would you really like to be suckled very long if you're a citizen of New Orleans by Mother Katrina, if she should come back to visit? Or do you want the Christmas tsunami to come visit again if you live anywhere in Asia? That's how nature treats us. Like a bunch of ants in an anthill that a child pours a bucket of water over. That's how much the physical world cares about us. Nature is beautiful, and God created it. But it's dangerous. It's deadly. It's not a place to go to find the comfort for a person who suffers. Six. The theology of the cross seeks virtues in faith, hope, and love. The theology of glory seeks virtues in sight, finality, and power. So the polarities are faith as opposed to sight. Theology of glory gives us proof, certainty. We get to see. Theology of the cross says, you simply have to trust that in those moments when the worst has happened, you fall into the lap of the gracious God. Hope instead of finality, you never get the final word in the theology of the cross. You still die asking, my God, why? You hope, like the rest of that psalm, that's Psalm 22 that Jesus dies, and it ends up as a prayer of hope. The psalmist says, you know, after all that stuff about my bones are sticking out, my tongue is dried up, they're casting lots for my clothes, the psalmist finally says, but I ain't gotten any place else to go, so I guess I'll just hang here and wait. I expect you'll do something, and I got time. I mean, what else are you going to say when you're crucified? Hope is what you get with a God who is with you in that not finality, and the virtue of love instead of the virtue of power. Seven. Theology of glory finds the first and last words about God as power, supremacy, and authority. Theology of the cross finds the ultimate words about God as compassion, mercy, grace, and benevolence. And you can study almost any theology looking for those two inclinations. Most of the theologies of the world are really about power and supremacy and success and happiness and getting ahead. The theology of the cross is most interested in compassion, mercy, grace, and benevolence. Eighth, we can discuss all this if I don't take too long. Theologians of the cross talk the cross instead of talking about the cross. When you read books like Ferdy and Hall, you find out that theology of the cross is really proclaiming the cross. It's not theology about the cross. There's a lot of theology about the cross. That is, trying to make sense of the cross, trying to say exactly how the cross worked as a saving event. We call these soteriologies, the study of how that crucifixion of 160-pound Jewish guy could be a saving event. I mean, the Romans killed an awful lot of people that way, thousands and thousands at a time on occasion. And now all of a sudden, the crucifixion of one 160-pound Jewish guy is the event that reveals God and changes the world? How can that be? Well, we get all manner of stories about how this can work. We call them theories of atonement or soteriologies. The most dangerous of them turn the story into a transaction. Well, God had to send somebody to pay the price, and everything got whomped on that guy, and the price was paid, and God was satisfied, and now everything's okay. The moment you turn it into a transaction, then you turn it into some kind of process that we got to get involved in somehow, rather than simply trusting that here is God for us, with us, on our side, on this side of all the shit that happens in the world. Theologians of the cross also have to talk about the cross, however. We can't simply just say cross, 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 cross. You know, I'm doing it right now. You know, that thing I just did about God showing up on our side of the abyss that separates us from God and that we find such a tortuous place to be. That's to talk about the cross and what it means. But the theology of the cross insists that every way of explaining it like that is both helpful and unhelpful. Because it's a human construction. It's a metaphor of human language and every metaphor in the whole world. And it's all we've got for talking to each other is metaphors. Every one of our words is finally a metaphor of some kind or another. They're all we've got. They're wonderful. They're beautiful. I love them. But they're all broken and they all lie. And so if you ever insist that one of your metaphors is the metaphor, you have an idol. You've tried to capture the fullness of what God is trying to reveal to us in one little explanation and then pretend that that's adequate and that now you've got it and we don't need any more and this is it and we've got God in our bottle now. No icon, no set of words can ever capture all there is to know about God and the meaning of the cross. And in fact, as I'll say in a moment, it's big trouble when you finally think you've got it right. The function of theology for a theologian of the cross is to search constantly for ways to talk about God that still, in my language and the language of the Lutheran confessions, honors Christ's death and comforts penitent hearts. The whole point of theology is to serve the proclamation that on the cross God has joined us. And to make sure that that proclamation remains comforting and honors Christ. Okay, that was a long one. That was number 8. Number 9. Proclaiming the crucified Christ and living out theology of the cross leads to suffering discipleship and it leads the church into danger so that the church becomes, you know, the Latin is Theologia Crucis, theology of the cross. Douglas John Hall has a whole chapter about the Ecclesia Crucis, the church, the crucified church. The Church of the Cross. But suffering is not the object of discipleship. The church doesn't go out looking for suffering, nor do we tell people that this is the point of the cross, that we too go out and try to get ourselves killed, or that people who are in positions of being killed should stay there because that's where they belong and put up with it. I'll talk about this more in a minute. This is one of the worst misconstruals of theology of the cross. When abused people are told, put up with it. This is your cross to bear. That is not, by any stretch of the imagination, theology of the cross. That is a perversion of it, but a common misuse of it that's around everywhere. But the point is that suffering is inevitable. It simply is the truth about this world. If we follow Christ, and if we are interested more in compassion and benevolence and mercy than we are in supremacy and power and glory, it's inevitable that we're going to get ourselves killed. It's also inevitable that the people that are into power and supremacy and glory are going to die too. They just are in denial about it. You know, someday they're going to get nailed. Because everybody gets nailed. Because sooner or later, some silent killer will betray you. And all your power and money in the world is not going to stave off your lung cancer. The system will get you. And sooner or later, you're going to be asking, my God, why have you forsaken me? The church that follows the suffering Christ often ends up there a little bit faster because you go to be with those who already got there. So, that's the next point. Theology of the cross does not glorify suffering or say that it's good. In fact, you know, just look at Jesus' life. As I said before, you can live the perfect life, and that's what you get. You still end up nailed. But the point of the cross is that when it does finally happen to us, look in whose company we land. Even if you never have another moment of suffering in your whole life, when that question finally comes to your lips, my God, why me? And my God, why you? Look who you're with. Finally, at last, after a whole lifetime of denial. I've got these sort of in an order that I don't really like, but this is the order I put them in. So this is the order that we'll do them. I hinted at this a little while ago. You can never keep theology of the cross straight. You can hardly even get it right in the first place. But once you get it right, you can't keep it straight. I can't keep it straight. I have to keep going over this over and over and over again, sitting with Pellet and talking about, now, have we got this? And that's because it is absolutely counterintuitive. It goes against everything that we are wired to believe about the world and the way the world is supposed to be. Because, you know, don't you find that vision of the world that's fixed the way the world really ought to be? And if we're going to have a Savior, that's what we should get out of it, is the fixed world. Or we ought to get something out of being believers. We ought to get something out of going the way of the cross. There ought to be some kind of reward. At least we should be happy. I was told in elementary school by a parochial school teacher that non-Christians who looked happy were secretly miserable. That we were happy. The world was, you know, our world was better and good, and their world was really crummy, but we just couldn't tell that. You know, they only looked happy. You know, this was somebody who didn't quite get it, you know, and thought that, well, there's supposed to be some reward, some payoff for being a Christian. You know, and that's just one example of how hard it is to keep straight. And just watch yourself. There's supposed to be some reward for this. It's supposed to get us somewhere. At least we should be happy. Another one is that at least it allows us to be right. You know, and that's what I grew up with. I grew up thinking that the whole point of being Christian was being right. The rest of the world was wrong. We're right. And that played into, many of you have heard me say this because I say it in practically every presentation when I get a chance. You know, my theory that being right is somewhere at the very top of the hierarchy of needs among human beings. That we would rather be right than anything. You know, we would rather be right than have food, water, sex, ice cream, whatever. And as I always say, if you don't believe me, get married. Yeah. Covenant with a lifelong partner, and you're in the best lab there is for learning the crucible of rightness. You know, that's what, you know, we want to be right. We want to have chosen rightly. We got the right ticket to the preferable afterlife. We're right. They're wrong. That's theology of glory. That's proof. That's sight. That's finality. That's not faith. That's not hope. That's not love. And it's precisely when you finally feel, and I do this all the time, and I'm probably doing it right now while I'm doing this, I'm finally getting it right. Well, it's just in that moment when I finally get it right that I'm in the most trouble. Because I've suddenly put something in the category of saying, well, at least Christ didn't need to die for this. At least he doesn't need to join me in that pile of doo-doo. This one's safe. Wrong. 13. Theology of the cross has, contrary to how it might sound, a high estimate of human capacity and dignity. Just the fact that we screw up all the time doesn't mean that this theology, that we admit in this theology that we screw up all the time, doesn't mean we don't have great capacity and dignity. It's simply that we have a totally realistic estimate of human alienation, as Douglas John Hall puts it. And we have a full sense, a sense of God's full and compassionate commitment to bringing humankind around to full authenticity, which is love and compassion and mercy and benevolence. Theology of the cross has a very high opinion of human beings. But also a really honest picture of our alienation from ourselves, from each other, and from God. That's what Luther means by saying that a thing is what it is, rather than lying about our alienation from each other, from ourselves, and from God. 14. This is one of my favorites, and this is sort of my own theory, actually. There is one benefit to being a theologian of the cross. You're blasphemy proof. You know, people are all upset now about the Da Vinci Code because it blasphemes, it makes Christianity look bad, makes God look bad. Blasphemy is a Greek word meaning to speak light of something, to talk about it as though it's of no account. To sort of treat something non-seriously. Well, maybe Da Vinci does that. I'm not really a fan of that book. You know, I don't really quite get exactly how upset some people are about it. Same way I don't quite get it that people got up so upset that got so upset that time about the artist who dipped a crucifix in urine. Or made a Virgin Mary at the New York Museum of Art out of buffalo dung and then painted the dried buffalo dung, and so we had a buffalo dung Mary and child. Now, and here's why I think we're blasphemy proof. You know, I mean, once you've been crucified, what else are they going to do to you? Hurt your feelings? You know, the picture of the church, my favorite picture of the church, is that crew in Luke's gospel hanging out there at Golgotha, crucified, talking about their plans. Imagine the soldiers listening to that. You know, there's two guys, and you know what crucified guys usually do? You know how they usually talk? Like the one guy in the picture. Hey, you jerk! Well, do something about it. Says you're a king. Oh, you can't point. Says you're a king. Do something about it. You know, or, you know, I know what I would do if I was crucified. I would have a few choice words for the centurion. You know, your mama is so... No. You know. But, you know, here's these two guys. And one of them says, hey, King Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. Jesus says, sure, buddy, you and me together today. Let's do it. I mean, imagine the soldiers listening to that. Is that a joke or what? Christianity is nothing if not a really good joke. You know, that Jesus is the Messiah? That Jesus is the emperor? That's what Lord means in the Gospel of John. Jesus is the new emperor because Pilate made him that. The Roman official made Jesus the new emperor. What a joke. So here's these crucified guys making plans. That's the church. That's the baptized. That's who we say we are. People who are crucified with Christ by baptism into his death. We're a bunch of crucified people saying, now what? Where do we go next? We got work to do. And people are going to make fun of us? What else could you do to us? We've been crucified. You're going to dip us in urine? I think we're blasphemy proof. That's one benefit of theology of the cross. 15. The purpose of life, I don't know about what comes after. But the purpose of life is not to escape hell and get to heaven. But the purpose of life is to break into hell, to find a way to get there. I did this in Bible class, or Bible sessions last week. Peter told his good buddy, or Jesus told his good buddy Peter, when Peter finally figured some things out about who Jesus was, blessed are you, Peter. Flesh and blood didn't reveal this to you, but it, you know, this comes from the Holy Spirit. Now what I want you to do is go straight to hell. They can't keep you out. The gates of hell cannot prevail against you. So what I want, I'm giving you the keys. You go there, you beat the door down, and you scare the hell out of them. By doing what? Forgiving sins. You go there with the presence of the crucified, suffering Christ. You go to the place where God is not, where they're all asking, my God, why have you forsaken me? Are you going to make us stay here forever? You go there, and you break in, and you unhell hell by being with the people who are in utter abandonment. That's the purpose of life. Now, usually they're in your own family. But there's other places. There are Ingrid visits them in all kinds of places. Death row. You know, some of us do that kind of dramatic work. But for most of us, it's quite a bit simpler. And finally, the last thesis is, if it's really true that following the cross bearer, Jesus, take up your cross and follow him, that you have to lose your life in order to gain it, and the only people that really ultimately finally lose their life are the ones that try to save it, then that's true for the church as well. And maybe we have to finally admit that the theology of the cross for the church is that the church also must die in order to live. Okay, that's the end of my thesis. So we have, oh my goodness, we only have 5 minutes. But we have time for at least a few questions and a bit of discussion. So what's on your mind about this?
Can you say some more stuff about the transaction? Because I think we're steeped in it. I think Aslan maybe has something to say. sounds like that's a bad place to go.
Yeah. I mean, I guess. Well, I'm tempted to simply say that that's nothing. To say that we believe in a crucified Messiah is just on the face of it to say that we have got hold of a mystery here, or we're trying to live with a mystery. That is God's response to the world, is to join us. God surely could have thought of something else. And we don't like to live with that mystery, so we try to explain it in such a way that it turns into a process that accomplishes something that we want accomplished. And all the transactional theology, you know, from Anselm and all the others who tried back in the early days of Christianity to offer these theories of atonement that would explain how God was up to something that finally fixed everything. Those are the transactions that the church has been conned into using over the centuries, which allow finally the church to be part of the transaction, and for the church finally to have power over people. And because once you have made yourself a part of the transaction that's going on, then you have power over the people who need this transaction to happen. You know, this is what the medieval church did with indulgences and with the way the forgiveness of sins got perverted. You know, if theology of the cross has the church, instead of tending some transaction where we're God's agents and we're making the transaction work, in theology of the cross, the church does what Christ does. The church joins the dying and the damned in their suffering, and takes with them the message that God is with them even now, as opposed to setting up a transaction.
I think I was getting at the ransom piece, because the whole notion of Jesus as ransom for us, is that something different?
No, that's one of the transactions. I mean, there are three fundamental types of soteriology, of theories of atonement. The sort of sacrifice one, where God uses Jesus like money to either, or a sacrifice, you know. So the ransom one is God has to pay to get us back. So God pays with the coins of Jesus' life and gets us back. Or God has to sacrifice an innocent victim, a la the old sacrificial system, to get us back. You know, there's the juridical one. You know, we're guilty, but God says, well, I'll kill an innocent guy instead so I don't have to kill all of you. I'll just kill one innocent guy. There's a sense in which those pictures do offer some truths about life. We are in bondage. We are sinners. We are guilty, and somehow or another something needs to happen to take care of that. And so how Jesus can be the means by which God takes care of all that, that's the burden of those theories. You know, the second one is the Christus Victor, that we are hostage to alien forces, and at the price of his own life, Christ enters the place where we are kept in bondage and frees us, but he dies. So it's like trading his life for ours. You know, and that's not a bad one too. And it's not all that transactional. That was Luther's favorite of the ones that's in the ones that are in the New Testament. And then there's the one that's kind of the mirror of God's heart. Human beings are alienated. God says, this is how far I'll go to be with you. Come home. You know, that's also, you know, theology of the cross can use that one. but the ones that set up a deal that has to get made are the dangerous ones that ultimately put the church in the process of helping the deal work, and instead of putting the church in the place of the cross bearers. Yes?
What does the resurrection mean?
Well, in theology of the cross, resurrection is the eschatological sign that, if nothing else, for lack of a better word, that Jesus was right, that it worked. We're not going to experience the resurrection. Look at Mark's gospel. You don't even get to see the risen Christ. You don't even know in Mark's gospel, Jesus doesn't know exactly what the outcome of this is going to be. He dies a faithful one. He doesn't die already vindicated. We die faithful ones. I don't know. I can't prove what's beyond the other side. But the resurrection of the dead in theology of the cross, the resurrection of Christ, is the eschatological sign that this death worked reconciliation of all the creation, God and God's world. But I'm not going to see it in the here and now. I can taste it. I can smell it in the bread and the wine and in your company. But in glimpses of the eschaton, in hope, not in finality. Yes?
In a really difficult time that I was experiencing, I had a professor of theology say to me, and you won't like this, but it was very helpful and offered hope, saying, well, Jesus does not just say, come and die with me, but come and die and live.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. My take on the Lazarus story, when Jesus raises Lazarus, you know what happens to Lazarus after Jesus gets him out of there and raises him from the dead? If you read John's gospel carefully, they hatch the same plot against Lazarus that they hatched against Jesus. So in effect, what Jesus does is go to Lazarus' tomb. And this is my paraphrase. He doesn't just say, Lazarus, get on out of there, and the rest of you get all that dumb clothes off of him. In effect, what Jesus does is say, Lazarus, come on out, because I'm coming in. Because he's on his way to die, right? Jesus is on his way to die. But even better, what he does is say, Lazarus, get on out of there. Let's go up to Jerusalem and die a real death. Let's go die a death that does something. Let's live a life that accomplishes something other than just dying of whatever. So it's not resignation. Theology of the cross is not resignation. And it is absolutely not resignation in the presence of evil. Theology of the cross takes the cross bearer straight into the face of evil to confront it and to call it evil, to name a thing what it is and to say, this is a mess. We stink. We're dying. This is killing us. Let's be honest about it and face it and do something. Yeah. It's not a call to die, it's a call to live. But it's a call to give your life. It's a call to sacrifice, giving your life away for the sake of love. One more question, and I think we have to quit for Vespers. Yeah, Ellen.
It always bothered me in the Creed when they say, he descended into hell. And is this part of the same?
Yeah, I think theology of the cross and descent to hell work really well together. The descent to hell is a phrase that only got into the Apostles' Creed in about the 8th century. It's a little difficult to tell exactly where they got it. One of the places they got it is from 1 Peter 3, where you have this image of Jesus alive in the spirit but crucified in the flesh, going to preach to the spirits who were in prison, that is, the people who missed the boat in the days of Noah. And so that's a metaphor for everybody who never made the boat. And the boat is the salvation raft, whoever it's for, the Jews or whoever. You know, and so God goes to the place, in Christ, God goes to the place where people are abandoned forever. And what do you think God says there? Theology of Glory says that Christ goes there to say, ha, 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 you guys lost, we won, we were right, you were wrong. Theology of the Cross says Christ goes, because you can never have theology of the cross except Jesus' message comforts. Theology of the Cross says Jesus goes there and says, even now, come with me, and unhells hell. If hell is where God is not and God goes there, Luther says, hell is unhelled. It is powerless. You can stay there if you want, but that's your choice. It's been emptied. Luther said, to say that Christ descended to hell is to say that there is no place where I can go that even there he is Lord, except even there he is Lord for me. So that's theology of the cross. That the one who dies on Calvary will join me in any abyss where I end up. That's the comfort of the gospel. And I think that's the end of bowling theology for June 25th. Thank you.